Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Imagine, if you will, the excitement of visiting a local drive-in with friends, family, or a significant other. No doubt you'd be looking forward to seeing a movie on a big screen on a lovely evening. Yet, what if that showing ended up with you witnessing something out of this world? You and everyone else there witnesses a UFO, and in an instant, your life is changed forever. Or perhaps you find yourself seriously ill and facing surgery, rehab, or even worse. How can you explain being visited by extraterrestrials who have come to either treat or even cure you of your medical issues? In his two most recent books, author and investigator Preston Denham documents hundreds of cases from these two aspects of ufology people seem loath to talk about. Preston covers cases that are simply amazing, coming up shortly. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. For $4 a month, you get ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also use the link in the show notes as usual. Mysteries and Monsters is on all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, let's welcome Preston back with some wonderful and remarkable encounters with UFOs. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back UFO and paranormal investigator Preston Dennett back to the show. With such a deep history of investigating, two of Preston's most recent books cover specific sections of ufology that often get overlooked. Both UFOs at the Drive-In and The Healing Power of UFOs are chock full of first-hand witnesses, opening up with some simply mind-boggling encounters. Preston, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me on.
Been keeping okay?
Oh, very busy. Keeping busy, which is good.
Yeah.
Having lots of fun.
Yes, yes. California looking after you, my friend.
Well, we're about 97 degrees today, but I know it's hot everywhere. I know you guys are hot too, so.
Oh, yep. It's the whole country's on red alert, as it literally is, for the temperature record to be broken here at the moment. So unprecedented scenes here in the UK, Preston.
Yes, well, that's weather for you. It's all over the map.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've kind of got away with it because it's been horrific in most of Europe since sort of beginning of June. So we've had a few hot days, but the last two or three, it's been unbelievably hot, even for somebody like me who loves it. So, as I said in the introduction, Preston, two of your most recent books cover two specific parts of ufology that I think are often sort of pushed to the margins when it comes to the subjects of ufology, primarily because I think some people just don't take this subject as seriously as we should. And yet, as you started your journey into ufology, as we mentioned on the first time you were on the show, it seems that once people know that you're very open-minded, people will come forward with their own personal experiences. And obviously, one of the cases in the Drive-In book was through somebody that you knew who decided to tell you about one of the best cases in the book, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I've had a lot of people say, you know, I haven't told anybody this, not even my spouse, family. But I've come to learn that there's quite a few people who've had encounters. I mean, I was skeptical. Did not believe in this for a second until I found out that my brother had seen one, my sister-in-law, several friends. Some had very close encounters. I mean, face-to-face encounters with ETs, grays, missing time, definitely people at work. Yeah, as you mentioned, one of them was a new lady who had come to our office, Claudia Blasios, and she found out I was a UFO researcher, and she's like, boy, do I have a story for you. And she did. I had never heard a story quite like this. This was my first introduction to what I would call UFOs over drive-in theaters. And she described how when she was a little girl, she went with her family to the Paramount drive-in here in Southern California. This was back in 1972. And this is a large drive-in. I mean, there's room for 300 cars at least. And she is in the back seat of her little Volkswagen Beetle with her little brother. Her parents are in the front seat. And she suddenly looks out to the side and sees people running away in panic. She says they were dropping their popcorn, their drinks, and screeching out of the theater. That, of course, made her curious. And she looked at her parents, and her parents were just dumbfounded. Her jaw was dropped. They were staring at forward as if entranced. And so she leans forward. She hadn't really been paying attention to the movie. But now, leaning forward, she sees a classic flying saucer, a silver disc. And it is right next to the movie screen. And when I say that, I mean, it was actually below the top of the screen itself, to the right. So, I mean, there's no chance of misperception here. This thing is very low level, and it's right there. And she said it was huge, practically not quite the size of the screen itself, but about half. And it had little colored lights around it, and it was going whoosh, 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 making a kind of a swishing noise, but pretty quiet. Just, she says, almost felt like it was watching them watch the movie. And it just stayed there. She says it stayed there for the longest time. And she described how cars were just screeching out, and said it was shiny silver like a spoon, chrome.
So I asked them, you know, did you see this object leave? And Claudia gave me a strange look. She's like, you know, honestly, I don't. And that's kind of where it stayed until a couple of years later. I mean, they actually forgot about it. They completely forgot about this sighting until about 2 years later, when Claudia's in the kitchen with her mom and they're listening to a radio show. And a guy calls in and he says he saw a UFO at the Paramount Drive-In and starts describing exactly what Claudia and her family saw. And Claudia turns to her mom and says, Mom, we were there, weren't we? And her mom says, yes, I remember that now. And they had forgotten. Claudia said, well, you know, why didn't we ever talk about this? You know, what happened? And her mom had no answer for it. But I was very interested to hear that, because this does turn up in a lot of UFO cases, particularly onboard encounters when people are, you know, say, contacted or abducted. There's no evidence that that actually happened. Not to rule it out. I mean, there was a lot of people there. That would be a huge case, but yeah, they completely forgot about it.
I mean, one of the things that strikes me about all of these cases in the book, because we're talking about drive-in theaters, which were real event moments for families and couples and friends. Lots and lots of people used to go to these showings in various states all across the US. And Claudia's is a prime example that a mass sighting where people have clearly had a reaction to what's going on, as she was describing everybody sort of running out of the theatre or screeching of tyres, Preston. I'm amazed that there aren't more sort of comprehensive experiences like this, because a lot of these sightings, there are hundreds of people at some of them.
Yes, and I only found, you know, I actually did find 100 cases after I was realizing this was a thing, you know, because I had no idea that UFOs were basically targeting drive-in theaters. And I'd been in this field for practically 35 years and had not heard of cases like this, other than this one, which I thought was a one-off.
Mm.
And this is one of the few cases where there is corroboration, but the vast majority involved, just one witness or, the couple that was there or the family. There are a few, five or so, in which multiple people reported it. But that is a curious feature to all this because, what's the average number of people at a drive-in theater? 100? 300?
Mm. And that's what is one of those things, like you were saying about Claudia and her mum is a prime example, because there are other stories that you've got in the book where witnesses have come forward, and there is this kind of people just don't want to talk about it, or nobody else that they see and they know are at the same venue and have the same experience seems to come forwards about it. And I suppose often when we have mass sightings of UFOs, it's very rare that there will be so many witnesses who seem to be so unwilling to come forward, especially in this day and age. Do you find that odd, the aspect of all these sightings at drive-in theaters, Preston?
I think there's probably multiple reasons why there's a lack of witnesses coming forward. And one could possibly be that people are not remembering it, because we do see that in some cases. I don't think that's really the case, because honestly, a lot of these witnesses are very much moved by the experience. I mean, they're frightened, they're excited, they're screeching out of the theater. I can't believe they would forget this.
Mm.
But I will tell you that everyone I've ever interviewed, I always ask them, did you report your sighting? Almost nobody does. And I'll be generous in saying it's 1 in 100, because pretty much nobody does. So I think that is the main factor. And I blame our own governments for covering up this subject. There is a ruthless cover-up. It's demonstrable. This is not speculation.
Hmm.
Our governments have spent an enormous amount of time, energy, and money to make UFO witnesses look ridiculous. The blanket explanation has always been hoaxes, hallucinations, misperceptions. There's nothing to this. You think you saw a UFO? Shut up. Go away. And it's real unfortunate. And I think that's the main factor going on here. I really do. I think there's multiple reasons why. Yeah, it really surprises me because, as I said, I've been in this field a long time and had no idea that there were so many cases like this.
Hmm. I think before I'd read your book, Preston, I have to say there was one incident of this nature that I was aware of, which in the realms of ufology is probably one of the most important sightings that's ever happened to the field, which is obviously the one that involved the legendary Peter Davenport.
Yes. Yes, that was really interesting to me, because he is such an influential figure in this field.
Mm.
And it really makes me wonder about it, because he was just a young kid and he was at the a drive-in theater with his family and saw this object, which was glowing bright red, kind of a oval shape. His whole family saw it. Well, his mom and his brother, they watched it for a good 5 or 10 minutes. In fact, it was casting this bright, eerie light over the whole theater. This was on July 17, 1954, at the Skyline Theater, St. Louis, Missouri. And Peter didn't know it, but his father was actually also watching this from the local airport control tower with binoculars, he and several other witnesses. And everyone was in awe. There was no real fear in this case. Everyone was just staring in complete amazement. And then some people decided they were going to try and approach this thing. And they started walking or running towards it. And that's when it took off. And everyone was deeply impressed. And Peter Davenport looks back on this case as the real moment which turned his life around. From that point on, he knew UFOs were real. He developed a very strong interest as he grew up and became, he wasn't an investigator or anything, but became friends with Robert Riddle, who was the head of the National UFO Reporting Center.
Mm.
And one day, Bob Riddle's like, this is just too much work for me. I'm going to have to give it up. I can't find anyone to take over. And Peter Davenport stepped in and says, I'll do it. I will take over. And he did. And so I don't know the ETs are doing this on purpose. If they knew at some point that Peter Davenport, you know, was going to be an influential figure in this field, certainly a remarkable coincidence, because if that sighting hadn't happened, we probably wouldn't have the National UFO Reporting Center today. And it's one of the biggest UFO reporting centers, certainly here in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Peter's done sterling work through my experience of knowing about him from sort of the late 90s onwards, Preston. So I think it's one of those incidents that you can often come across in certain fields, be it cryptozoology or the paranormal or ufology, where one particular person has an experience that changes their life. But in Peter's case, it changed the lives of thousands of people, because he became such a direct connection for a lot of people in the late 90s and early noughties who knew that they had one person who would listen to them and take them seriously.
Exactly. And that's why I wonder about this, because these drive-in theater cases are unlike anything else in this field. I mean, your average sighting is kind of a distant light at night. It flies by. It's very brief, quite high up there. But these are different. These are very low-level sightings. These are often long-lasting. I mean, we're talking 5 minutes on the lower end, but you know, upwards of 15, 20 minutes, an hour, 2 hours in some cases. And not only are these, you know, low-level, long-lasting sightings, they're, of course, very widely viewed. There's really nothing like that except perhaps schoolyard encounters. But those are kids for the most part. And I started looking at outdoor concerts and sporting events, and I did find a few, but not 100. And it's well more than 100. I mean, I'm still getting cases. And what's even really more interesting about this is when these objects drop down, and it's almost always right over the screen or right to the left or the right of it, they will put on a show. I mean, I'm not kidding. They will actually flash their lights. They will start dancing around. They will release smaller objects as if they know people are there to have some entertainment. And they will put on a show for you. And I think, honestly, the agenda behind this is to announce their presence. They want people to know about them, because this is a clear type of behavior that UFO researchers call a display.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, their UFOs are evasive. You can't just go out and see one anytime you want. But here they are clearly wanting to be seen.
I find it fascinating as well, because it would be very easy, Preston, for anybody that's not really looked at this subject or these particular cases and the events that they occur in conjunction with, to kind of dismiss it, as you said earlier on, about it being a hoax or a hallucination. Or for many people, they say, oh, well, it's the 1950s. Everybody was seeing UFOs in the 1950s. But as your book shows, this has carried on through decade after decade after decade up to the modern era. This is not something you can just sort of poo-poo or brush away and say, oh, well, it was just the hysteria of the 1950s. Because for me as well, when you look at your book, there are some astounding cases that happened in the 1960s. There's two in particular in 1966, which are both really well documented. The witnesses are very clear in what happened, which I think were at, is it South Hutch in Arkansas and the Bogalusa drive-in?
Right, right. The South Hutch case is definitely one of my favorite. I was actually in Kansas, and I talked to the witness firsthand. Many of these cases I did find in the various UFO organizations, their databases, or in newspapers. Honestly, I didn't find hardly any in books.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, I have like two, three, you know, probably closer to 400 books now. And I found one in a book. Almost all these cases were in, I got out of a news clipping service or UFO databases like APRO or NICAP or QFOs and so forth, New Fork, MUFON. But the South Hutch case, I talked to the witness firsthand. His name was Pat Mitchell, and he went with his friend. He was just 19 years old or so, to see the latest James Bond flick at the South Hutch Theater, which is a big theater. This theater was pretty new. The screen is 52 feet wide and 120 feet high. And they got their popcorn. You know, they got there early so they could get a good seat right in the center. or a good parking spot, I should say, and hooked up their little speaker at drive-in theaters, that little mobile speakers you hooked up to your car.
Yeah.
So they're sitting there watching the movie. It's very exciting. You know, it's James Bond. And his friend, Pat's friend, says, "Do you see that light?" And Pat says, "Well, of course I do." Because off to the right of the screen, right in their view line, but fairly off in the distance, was this very bright light getting bigger. It's obviously something in the sky approaching them. And it took just a few moments, less than 5 minutes, before it became clear that this was coming right for them. And it stops right to the right of the screen, exactly like with Claudia Blasios. And again, this screen was 52 feet wide. And he says this took, you know, it was about slightly over half the size of the screen. So he's guessing 30 feet wide. And this is a beautiful, classic flying saucer, like two bowls stuck together. And it was beautiful, he said. It had colored lights on it, you know, red, blue, green, yellow. And they were flashing, and it was just hanging there. And people jumped out of their cars. They were looking at it. There was no fear in this case. It's interesting. Sometimes they will, people just panic.
Yeah.
And other times they're like, wow, look at this. So, and this was 1966, he estimates. It could have been a year earlier or a year later, but around there. And so they're watching this, and he says it stayed there for 5 minutes. And then this thing moves behind the screen. It disappears behind the screen and comes off to the left side of the screen, and it's slightly higher up now, maybe 50, 100 feet, stays there another 5 minutes. Everyone's still watching it. And then this UFO, and this is why I think they're doing this on purpose, circles around the entire theater. There's a full revolution around the whole parking lot, and as if to make sure that everybody's seeing it. And then once it does a full circle, it stops over the road that leads into the theater and starts heading down the top of the road, you know, just 100 feet high, at about 30 miles an hour. And everyone just screeches out of the theater to follow it. And, you know, Pat and his friend, of course, did so too. And they were in sort of the center of this huge convoy of, the estimates could have been anywhere from 30 to 50 cars or more, just heading down the highway following this object, which led them, get this, for 6 miles down this highway in Kansas, and stops, pulls over to the side of the road, goes up a little bit more, so now it's maybe 200 to 300 feet high, which is not that high up for something like this. You could still clearly see this was a UFO. And everyone stops in the middle of the highway. They're getting out of their cars. They're like, look, it's a UFO. Oh, my gosh. Staring at it for 5 minutes or so. And this thing takes off straight up. It's a tiny little dot in the sky. And it's gone. And what's an interesting end note to this whole case is Pat was a photographer for the local newspaper. He kicks himself for not taking his camera that day as he was driving. But, you know, who does that anyway? But at any rate, he goes, people were talking. They're like, I'm going to tell the newspaper. And so he knows that people went to the newspaper because a bunch of people were just talking. It was the buzz of the town. You know, South Hutchinson, Kansas was not a huge town, certainly not in 1966. It's still not. And so he waited the next day for what he was sure was going to be an article. 2 days, nothing. So he goes to the newspaper himself. He's got connections there. And he says, what's up? How come, you know, what's up with the driving UFO? And everyone he talked to played dumb, like they had never heard. And he knew that they did know about it because he knew people who had gone there. He asked them. And that's when rumors start flying around town that military officials, government officials showed up and quashed the story. Do not publish it. Which is not the only case where there's government interference in some of these cases, where, you know, jets might show up, or even, and there's one case where government vehicles showed up, army vehicles, and ordered everyone to leave. The UFO is still there.
The last couple of lines in that particular witness statement make me chuckle as well, because I know Pat was, as you've said earlier on, Preston, a lot of these people don't say anything for years, primarily because we both know just how some people are treated by friends and family and work colleagues and things when they say they've seen strange things in the sky or whatever. However, this is an extremely full-on encounter seen by numerous people to the point that they even followed it in a massive convoy. That decades later, he was outside staring at the night sky and his daughter came out and said, "Oh, what are you doing, Dad?" And he said, "Oh, I'm looking," and tells her what happened. And he just says, she looked at me with concern. He said, "But I know where I saw."
Yeah, this is so unfortunate. This is why people don't share it with their family. They don't want to be thought crazy. I really have to hand it over to people, kudos to people who have the courage to step forward and say, "Listen, I don't care what you think. I saw this."
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I know this is being covered up. There was a very early case. This is one of my favorite cases. August 12th, 1952, terrorist drive-in in Bakersfield. This is a pretty large drive-in, space for 650 cars.
Hmm.
And this UFO drops down. It's a cylindrical shape. These are all different shapes and sizes. Usually your classic saucer, but this one was a cylindrical object, almost the length of the entire screen. Drops down, it's right over the screen like they do. It flashes its lights like they do. This was a brief sighting. It just flashed its lights and then it took off. Well, it turns out there was an Army officer in the audience, Lieutenant Jenkins. And at that time, the press would really only listen to people who were military officers. They didn't want to hear from, you know, citizens.
Yeah.
So he decides he's going to report it. And he calls the local Kern County Sheriff's Office, and Deputy Leroy Hatfield answers and takes his report, hangs up the phone, and the phone rings again. It's another person from the theater. And after taking four or five calls, he says, "You know what? I'm going to go over there." And so he goes over there, and there's still 100 people just talking and talking. And he takes the testimony of about 30 or 40 people, and everyone's lining up. He's like, "That's enough. My arm's tired. I got a good handle on what you saw. I will make a report."
Hmm.
Long story short, he sends this report out to Project Blue Book, the precursor of it, and sent it to Edwards Air Force Base, which was the closest Air Force base. And they take his report very seriously. They write it up in a document, which I found online, declassified, marked action. And this is so interesting to me. This report was sent the next day to the Air Technical Intelligence Command at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, which is UFO Central. If you know anything about UFOs, probably heard of Wright-Patterson.
Yep.
And then, not only that, sent to Ent Air Force Base in Colorado, which is where we track all the incoming and outgoing aircraft of any kind.
Yeah.
And get this, to the Director of Intelligence at Washington, D.C. So this was taken very seriously. You cannot tell me our government does not know about UFOs or UFOs at the drive-in, because there's the proof right there. I mean, the documents show this. And it's not the only one where it was sent, you know, to Wright-Patterson or very high levels of intelligence. I mean, there was a case in 1950 where the report was sent immediately to Colonel John Meade, the commanding general at Wright-Patterson. So they know. They know, and have known from the beginning exactly what's going on.
I know you mentioned it earlier, and I found it remarkable, as you've said, that when you looked in the books and some of the most famous literature about the UFO subject and books that have covered sightings, nobody seems to have touched this section of it. Preston, do you have any sort of inclination as to why people have kind of gone, "Oh, we're not covering this"? Because when you read the book, one of the other sightings, which is one of those that you just find completely incomprehensible that you can dismiss it, was the other one in 1966 with the lady called Serena, who at Bogalusa Drive-In, who actually viewed it through her rifle scope. So we're talking about people who have clear views, often with friends. I mean, I think this girl, Serena, her parents actually ran the drive-in theater.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great case. It's not one of the most widely viewed ones by any means, but there certainly are a lot of them. And the only one I could find was at another theater, which is written up in the book by Somewhere in the Skies. Yeah, the Bogalusa case is very interesting because this one does involve humanoids. Her parents ran this little drive-in theater in Louisiana, and she went out, you know, she came home late. Normally she helps, but she was at school, came home late, and decided she was going to do some hunting in the wilderness behind the theater. And comes over this little rise and sees this classic disc, a flying saucer with big, you know, windows, and she can see figures inside. And they're just kind of silhouettes, but they look human as far as she can tell. And it's totally silent, and it's, she watches it through the scope of her rifle for several minutes, 15 minutes or so. And I mean, these are big 2-foot-high windows. And so she's just watching and watching. But mind you, this is behind the audience, so no one in the theater can really see this unless they turn around. That's behind the projector booth. But she says these guys are actually watching the movie. She can see them walking up to the windows and watching the movie. And so she decides, she's thinking, you know, this probably military. And she still wonders to this day, could this be a, you know, secret military craft? I honestly don't think that that's...
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
True. I mean, I can only speculate, but it seems odd to me that they're going to be hovering right next to a driving theater where people could see them.
Yes.
And spending their time watching a movie. This does not sound like how you test, you know, secret craft. But, you know, the fact that there were human-looking ET, or figures, I should say, I think caused her to conclude that this could very well be military. But if you know this field, there's lots of human-looking ETs. At any rate, she decides she's going to flash her light at them. Her dad's in the military. You know, they talked about all the jokes and pranks that they would pull on each other. So she's like, okay, I'm going to just flash my lights at them. Because she had a hunting light, big old, you know, very powerful flashlight. And so she flashes it at them. She says the reaction was instantaneous. The bright yellow lights in the interior immediately turned to red. This craft starts lifting up, makes a loud whining noise, sort of an electrical noise, which actually reminded her of the electrical system they had at their own theater to, you know, run the lights. And it starts moving off. So it's slow at first, but it's picking up speed. And she's just a couple hundred yards from the projection booth, and it turns out she's a long distance runner. I mean, she's, you know, runs track at college. And so she takes off at high speed to the projection booth and tells her dad, says, look, look, look. And by now this craft is pretty much on the horizon. And she says, look, do you see that? And he says, yeah. And she says, what do you think it is? He says, I think it's a plane. And she says, no, it's not. It was a saucer. I saw it from just, you know, 200 feet away. It was totally silent. There were people in it. And he looked at her like she was on drugs, what she said. So she kind of clammed up. And she kept this secret for almost her entire life. She was, I believe, in her 70s when she finally just decided, I'm going to report this to the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. But one of three or four cases involving humanoids. And again, I think when someone has an experience like this, they usually do not report it. And I have to tell you, if there's 100 cases out there, that I found 100 cases, and let's say the average number is 300 people in a theater, that's like 30,000 people. And I can tell you for sure that since one in only 100 people report this, there's 100 more cases.
Yeah.
So we're looking at a minimum of 300,000 people with seeing UFOs at drive-in theaters. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but numbers don't lie.
Yeah, yeah. I think as well, one of the things that's quite striking, which probably leads into the next event I want to cover, is that in the majority of the cases that you've got in the book, Preston, people seem quite excited, or it's just something coming and almost having a nosy, or just seeing what's going on here, as almost the screens attracted them. as a bright light, and they've come down to sort of see what's going on here or whatever. And in the majority of the cases in the book, there doesn't seem to be any kind of sort of negative reaction or negative response to the event, other than initial fear and obviously people being quite shocked at something so strange turning up whilst they're just enjoying a movie. But I know the Ascot Park Drive-In Theatre, which is, I think, was reported to you by a gentleman called Scott Santa in the 1970s. That seems to be one of those where there's a real sort of concerning aspect to this particular event.
Yeah, that is one that really makes me wonder, because this was in August of 1974. This was on the East Coast, Ascot Park Drive-In. And I did talk to the witness firsthand, Scott Santa. And he was there at the theater watching the movie with everyone when this huge triangular or sort of boomerang-shaped craft, flat black, comes over the theater from behind it, as they usually do, directly over it. And he says it was so low, probably, you know, it's kind of cliche, but he could have picked up a rock and hit it with it. It was maybe 100, 200 feet up. And he says, as it goes over the theater, all the power goes out. The screen, some cars were coming in or going out. They powered out. The snack stand, the street lights on the side of the road, everything went completely black. And he said this object was so large, it covered the entire parking lot. So it was larger than the screen itself. And people just got out of their car and were just entranced, almost zombified is the word he used. The air felt heavy. It was hard to move. There was an eerie silence. His ears actually popped. And he says it could have been as low as 50 feet overhead. And just kind of, it was very quiet, maybe a low thrumming noise. And just moves over the theater. Didn't appear to stop, not that he remembers. And it moves on. And as soon as it leaves the premises, the lights go back on, like a switch being, you know, turned on. The movie theater screen goes on. The movie starts playing. All the lights go on. Everyone kind of climbs back into the car and just starts watching the movie. Not one word was said about it. And in fact, Scott says, really, the next thing he remembers is standing in this, you know, snack stand, going to the bathroom. No one was talking about it. He completely forgot about it. Did not think about it until he went to the bookstore and saw a book that had the word UFO on it. And this memory just drops into his head and shakes him to his core. It's like, how could I have forgotten this? And to this day, he wonders if he had missing time. An abduction. He's kind of scared to go under hypnosis. He's no longer in touch with his friend, so he can't follow up on that if his friend remembers or not. But this is one of several cases where people don't remember. In a number of these cases, they're what we would call a close encounter of the second kind, meaning it did affect the environment. Most of these I would call simple sightings, close encounter of the first kind. But honestly, if you call them all, every single one of them, a close encounter of the fifth kind. And by that, I mean a human-initiated encounter, because in effect, these objects are being provoked into a sighting. I think, you know, they see this theater, these huge screens, these beams of light, all these cars, and that's attracting them. So this would be a great place to do live UFO field work, or, you know, what we call CE5s, and try to call down or communicate with the UFO. But yeah, that case, I still wonder about it. I honestly think that could have been a mass abduction. There are cases of mass abductions. They're very, very rare. But all the details in this one points towards that.
I think one of the other things that really strikes me, as you were saying about how many cases you've uncovered so far, and we can only surmise just how many of these did actually happen, Preston, because drive-in theatres in the 50s and 60s were all across the states, from New York all the way down to California. They were everywhere. Every major town and even small towns had them. It was the in thing in those days. So, you know, we're talking about hundreds and thousands of these drive-in theatres all across the country, showing films for decades. So the potential of repeat events seems to be quite high, even though we're looking at such a small group of reports so far. But I had to smile when I read the two events that happened at the same place, which is Chula Vista. So when you were doing the book, were you surprised that there was only one that had a repeat performance that was public knowledge? Or did you think that, obviously, because of other aspects of this, because obviously a lot of drive-in theatres by the late 90s, early noughties had unfortunately closed down, Preston. So the chances of something coming back to somewhere would be reduced because perhaps the drive-in theatre wasn't even there anymore. But in Chula Vista, it still was.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually a few cases where there was repeat performances, an encore presentation, if you will. But yeah, I really looked into this and the geography of it, because throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that was the heyday of drive-in theaters, was the number one pastime for families here in the U.S. And it would hold, balloon rides and prize giveaways and movie star appearances and petting zoos and all kinds of stuff to attract visitors. It was a huge thing here in the U.S., and it still is. It declined rapidly in the 70s and 80s due to, home movie theaters and VCRs and a number of factors. But it's still going on today. I kind of look at them as these events as very much like what a musician does or a writer of novels who has a book tour or a concert tour and goes from city to city and does an appearance and tries, publicizes their work. And that's what these UFOs are doing. They'll pick a theater, do their little show, pick another one in another state, pick another one. They're just bouncing from theater to theater to theater, putting on a show. But I think one of my favorites, one that just made me laugh out loud when I found it, took place in Canada on Prince Edward Island. This is largely a U.S. phenomenon, but there are some cases outside the U.S., Canada, certainly. Boy, there's one case in China. Chilling. But this case in Charlottetown in Prince Edward Island in the late 1960s, this UFO hovered over the same theater so many times that the owners started advertising in their flyers, if you want to see a UFO, come to the drive-in, because they kept turning up. The Yuma drive-in in Arizona had three visitations over a period of a decade. The Chula Vista in California had a couple. But generally speaking, there's just one appearance at each. As far as I can tell, they just pick a theater and then move on to the next one. But sometimes they'll definitely come back for a encore presentation.
Clearly, even the UFOs have their favorite drive-ins then, Preston.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me. I think the case that really just made, had me scratching my head, because I was trying to figure out what's going on here. Why are they doing this? Are they watching the movie? I even looked at, the movies that were being played, but they were all across the genres. The Simpsons movie, Jurassic Park, Exorcist, Outlaw Josie Wales. You name it. It was just different movies each time. I think the one case that kind of clinched it for me comes from UFO researcher George Fawcett, very well-respected guy. In May of 1963, he found out about a case that took place at the Wellington Circle Twin in Medford, Massachusetts. And everyone was watching the movie when these two discs showed up. And in this case, it wasn't right next to the screen, but rather right to the side of the parking lot. These two discs show up, and then moments later, the discs rise up a little bit, and two more come and park themselves sort of right beneath the first two. And then all four rise up, and two more come. And then two more after that. So now we have eight discs in two columns. And once everyone is pretty much out of their cars and no one's watching the movie at this point. they're all watching the better show. And this is when they put on a clear display. For 45 minutes, these two columns of discs started rotating in this musical chair kind of fashion, just obviously putting on a show. After 45 minutes, they took off one after another. So you can't tell me that they're not wanting to be seen. Because I started finding more and more cases very much like that. This is obviously an agenda to announce their, I'm speculating here, but I can't imagine why they're doing this other than to want to be seen.
I know you touched on it at the beginning of the conversation, but since the book's been released, how many more have you sort of uncovered? Or is it one of those cases, Preston, that whenever a researcher or an investigator releases a book on a specific topic, often that kind of shakes more witnesses out of the tree, as it were?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened. I expected it. You know, I've done enough research and put out enough books where I started to realize, well, gosh, I can never close an investigation because always there's new information coming in. But it was quite surprising to hear. I got about 10 new cases, and I expect that I will be getting more. People are quite shocked to read these accounts, particularly if they're a witness themselves. And it's so interesting because every time someone's like, oh, well, thank you so much. No one listens to me. They actually doubt their own eyes. And people don't understand why the heck aren't more people reporting this.
Yeah.
One guy absolutely refused to give too much information because he wanted to sort of verify any future reports. He remembered the movie. It was a double feature. He remembered the movies that were being played. He remembered the exact location, which he would not release. Yeah. I know that there are far, far more cases than the 100 I was able to, you know, document.
Well, it's a fantastic... I have to say, Preston, it's one of my favourite books that I've read in the recent years in regards to the UFO phenomenon, because it is just genuinely really interesting. And as you were saying about some of the film choices, there's one case that's fairly recent. I think it was from 2014 that made me laugh, that they remembered that the film that was on was The Guardians of the Galaxy. So clearly they've got a real appetite for all kinds of films from different genres regardless. And that's the other thing about this. You could, as we were saying about how they've been dismissed, if people were all watching science fiction films, then maybe you could say this was an overactive imagination. But they're clearly not, as the one of the reports earlier you mentioned, the witnesses remember it was a James Bond film. So it's not even as trivial. You can't even trivialize it on that basis, really.
Yeah, and most people actually don't remember the movie.
Yeah.
The movie just wasn't as interesting. What I remember is the sighting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I can totally relate to.
Well, as you say about this book coming out, sort of releasing more witnesses, your other book that I want to cover today is in regards to the healing power of UFOs. Now, this was originally your first book, I think, back in the mid-90s, Preston. And at that point, you had, once again, just over 100 cases in that one. And yet, you've had to sort of update it and release it because, once again, since that book's release, you have had a consistent stream of witnesses coming forward to tell you about their own personal experiences with a wide variety of ailments that seemingly have been cured, or they've even been given medical advice to get something sorted based on some kind of encounter. And I know when you were writing the introduction for the book, one of the bits that made me chuckle was that you'd even had letters from people asking you to put them in touch with aliens so they could get some medical assistance.
Yes, which I would love to be able to do. Hey, I could use a few healings myself here and there.
Join the club.
The darn book. It's like, hey, guys. But yeah, that was 1996 when I put that book out. It was my first book. And I was shocked to find so many cases, and no one was talking about it. This is the first book to cover this topic. Since then, there's been a number of other researchers who have looked into this and put out books. And immediately, I started getting more cases. Every single time, almost without exception, that I spoke on this subject at a convention or, you know, a radio show or what have you, someone would contact me and come up from the audience like, oh, you know, I was cured of deafness, one guy said. Another said that he had an infection on his tattoo and they cured him of that. One had a mole or a, you know, a pimple or something, cured him of that, a boil. So I think there's far more cases than, you know, I ended up years later putting out a new book just recently, The Healing Power of UFOs, which has 300 cases. And I have to tell you, Paul, every single major researcher out there, almost without exception again, has cases like these and are not really discussing them Bud Hopkins had cases. He wrote 6-7 books, never once mentioned UFO healing cases. I had to ask him personally, face to face, do you have cases like this? And Bud Hopkins is, of course, at the time, the leading researcher into UFO abductions.
Yes.
He said, yes, yes, we do have cases like this, and I'm very encouraged by them. But David Jacobs, another leading researcher, has multiple cases. People cured of diphtheria, pneumonia, cancer. John Mack has cases. Barbara Lamb, Edith Fiore, Tim Beckley, Philip Mantle, Michael Hesseman. It's all over the world. Cases stretch back at least 100 years. I think the U.S. is the leading number of reports. Canada next, England third, or Russia. Now, those are the top four, which I think you'd expect. But, yeah, it's absolutely all over the world. It was really surprisingly spread out equally geographically all across our planet.
Hmm. Do you think that the reason this subject doesn't seem to be broached by many researchers, Preston, is a very similar kind of tarnish that seems to be attached to the abduction phenomena and the experiences that come forward in regards to that, that some people think it's too far beyond the pale for some researchers? Because I find it incredible that people like Bud Hopkins and John Matt would be aware of it. But even with the subjects and the witnesses that they investigated and they wrote about, even for those people, they thought that this was a bit too much. And yet, when you look at this, some of these people are claiming to have been given superpowers, or the vast majority of them are not claiming to be taken from death's door to being a pristine example of health and fitness, Preston. A lot of them have minor ailments, slight things that suddenly just seem to clear up for no reason, apart from the fact that they've had some kind of experience. So do you think this is one of those facets of ufology that people just don't want to touch it because they think it's too much, even though you've spoken to a lot of witnesses firsthand, and clearly there's a lot of compelling evidence for some of these cases?
Yeah, 100%. You hit the nail on the head, and it's very frustrating. And I'd say that this was a much bigger factor many years ago when I first wrote this book and started researching it. I think today people are more accepting of it, but UFOs themselves, you know, claiming an encounter is already on the fringe. And saying you were healed by friendly ETs, well, that was just way too much for a lot of people to accept, certainly at that time. And it was very frustrating because I kept finding these cases and there was very little information on them. They were mentioned almost as if it was an embarrassing event. And another thing is fear cells. A lot of people were much more interested, well, certainly the media, in cases of scary abductions. And these were very friendly cases. So I think that's one of the reasons why there wasn't a lot of discussion about this or a lot of research into it.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, after I put out that book, it got the cover of the MUFON Journal, the cover of many magazines. I got on TV. John Mack actually mentioned, you know, my research in his next book, following his, you know, bestseller Abduction.
Yep.
So people did start paying more attention to these things, but initially, no. And it's still, I think, not as accepted as, say, a, you know, scary abduction. But I can tell you that this is one of their main agendas. I can tell you this with full confidence, because when people are taken on board, the single most common experience is being physically examined.
Mm-hmm.
And this is often when people are healed. And I think ETs, and I think that's what we're dealing with here, you know, extraterrestrials in the classic sense, really know more about the human body than we do. Because many of these cases that I found, which are very well documented, by the way, some of them extraordinarily well documented with doctors' statements and people cured of chronic diseases. So in the 30 cases of cancer healed, and some of these witnesses are doctors themselves. So, yeah, very well documented. And I think, I don't know, it's frustrating that these aren't getting more attention. I can't quite figure it out.
I think it's often, for me, quite surprising, because certainly not to your level of investigation or research, Preston, but I know enough about the history and a large amount of cases in the UFO field to know that often anything that doesn't, even in this open-minded era that we find ourselves in now, even for some people, there are certain types of cases or certain witnesses or certain famous incidents over the years that people just don't want to touch because they're classed as being too weird. And I always find this really quite odd when we're dealing with this, because we're dealing about a weird situation here. We're dealing about a very strange subject on whatever level you want to look at it. And even if you work on the basic principle that this is extraterrestrial contact from races outside of our known knowledge, I can't understand where you draw the line in regards to where your incredulity begins. Do you know what I mean? Because it's I'm not saying you should accept everything, because there have obviously been hundreds of people that have promoted themselves as contactees and experiencers or witnesses, and they've made it all up. However, there's a far larger amount of witnesses and contactees and experiences that haven't made things up, Preston, and are often, as we've just been saying, too frightened to come forward because of the way that they will be seen.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about these healing cases is this is what we would term medical evidence.
Yeah.
This is, you know, medical evidence always excites researchers, because this is something you can point to that is, you know, something you can actually study, you know, in a sort of laboratory setting. Or, you know, it's hard to explain away. It's not resting just on a person's eyewitness testimony.
Hmm.
And some of these, and there was a case in Brazil where a guy was struck by a beam of light from a UFO, and it did cause some medical injuries, as we would think of it. He had nausea, vomiting, sort of like radiation sickness to a degree. But he started to grow a third set of teeth, and he's 70 years old. And he ended up being examined by some 50 other doctors, UFO researchers, government officials. It's a very, very well-documented case. And this is one of the classic in the literature that does have a lot of information on it. The witness was Ventura Maceres. He was 73 years old. He was a night watchman. And a very well-documented case with lots of evidence behind it. And yet, most of these cases, despite having actual physical evidence, don't get the attention. And in fact, if you look at the MUFON UFO Investigator's Handbook, which is what they give to people who investigate this subject, there is a chapter on how to handle physiological evidence. But the chapter is called Medical Injuries as a Result of a UFO Encounter.
Mm.
And completely ignores the fact that there are many, many healing cases, and they're extraordinarily well documented. I mean, there was a case on September 3rd, 1965, involving two police officers in Damon, Texas, who were struck by a beam of light from a UFO, and one of the officers had a wound on his finger. His son's baby pet alligator had bit his finger and caused a pretty nasty wound. It was bandaged up. It was swollen. It was painful. This beam of light from a 300-foot wide UFO strikes him. He could feel the beam, scares them half to death, and they drive off, and they park in a diner, and he pulls off the bandage, and his cut was completely gone. And what I like about this case is one of these guys, there was two police officers, Deputy Robert Good and Deputy Billy McCoy. Well, one of them was a supervisor with 50 people under him. These are police officers who are trained observers. This case was witnessed by, you know, multiple people. It's not just one guy saying this. He has a corroborating witness. They were interviewed by Major Leach in the nearby Air Force Base. So it's very well documented. And it did get a lot of attention, but still didn't really bring this subject of UFO healings.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
To the forefront of research, and people still look upon it as like a fringe part of this field.
Mm. Do you think it's because, despite the fact that there's medical evidence, that once again, when we talk about anything that's outside, as you say there in the MUFON handbook, it's all about people being injured by them, which is, when you look at this volume of work that you've collected so far, Preston, I would imagine once again that you're still getting experiencers contacting you and explaining what's happened to them and supplying more evidence from their medical practitioners to validate what they're actually saying. We always seem to be, it's one of those things, especially in this era, we tend to focus on the more negative encounters or the scary ones, whereas the vast majority, well, nearly all the encounters that are included in the Healing Power of UFOs are overall a positive experience for that person, despite any initial fear that they may have until they realize that what's happening is a positive experience.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem of why this hasn't been more accepted and noticed and publicized. Because if someone has a scary encounter, you know, it's causing them emotional problems and anxiety and PTSD, they will seek help. They will report it because they're having a hard time with it. They will find a hypnotherapist, perhaps. And these taste, you know, fear, of course, sells in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a main factor why we hear a lot more about traumatic and negative cases. Whereas, let's say, you know, a UFO dropped down and cured you of your lower back pain. Mind you, I've got 10 cases. Or, you know, healed you with nearsightedness. Or, you know, a cut on your finger or something. Who are you going to tell? Who's going to believe you? It's a big pill for people to swallow. The whole UFO field is. I mean, it involves telepathy and levitation and movement through solid objects and, you know, non-human figures. So it's a lot already. But to add in, like, well, I was healed, a really difficult thing for, I think, people to accept. In fact, there's one guy I interviewed, a really wonderful man. Michael Carter is his name. He's a reverend, a healer, a speaker, an author who was actually commended by President Clinton for his social efforts against racism. He draws life as had encounters with grays, but in 2013, he was diagnosed with a blood clot in his leg while living in Asheville, North Carolina. And on July 4th, 2013, he was trying to sleep. A lot of firecrackers were going off. Finally, it stopped. And in the middle of the night, this human-looking figure appears in his room.
Hmm.
This is what we would call Nordics. I don't really like that term.
Yeah.
I would call them human-looking ETs.
Yeah.
But this is a very muscular, beautiful, blonde-haired man. And he puts out his hand, didn't have any instrument in it. So this is quite unusual. Some of these healings, most of them, I would say, are done with instruments involving light. But some involve what I would term psychic healing or hands-on healing along those lines. And this is one of them. This blue light came out of this guy's hands and struck Michael Carter on the chest and face, and he was quite dazed by it, fell asleep, woke up the next morning and got a huge shock. His leg, which had been swollen to almost twice its size, was now normal size, and he was perfectly healthy. The blood clot was gone. He had gone to the doctor. The doctor was horrified. You know, this blood clot, he said, you should have come in much earlier. Don't you realize this is life-threatening? This is going to take months to cure. And you put him on this cocktail of medicines and blood thinners and what have you. But this next morning, he wakes up, his leg is normal. The veins actually look rerouted, as if something had, you know, completely redesigned his leg. And he was having regular doctor visits. He goes to the doctor. And the doctor, of course, is out of his mind. He's like, what the heck? How did this happen? You know, what happened? Your leg looks great. This is impossible. And Michael Carter says, just be happy for me. It was a miracle. He didn't want to tell him. Yeah. And very, very rarely are people upfront with their doctors about this. I did talk to one guy who had cancer who was cured, and he was very upfront from the beginning with his doctor, because he was having a lot of medical, you know, evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But most people know, they don't tell their doctors. And the doctors, these cases leave a long, long trail of mystified and actually somewhat angry and puzzled doctors.
I've often thought about this when I've read the book, Preston, how many doctors around the world have dealt with people with serious conditions. As we're talking, blood clots can obviously kill you. And there are numerous other cases of quite severe and debilitating diseases that people have been suffering from that seem to vanish overnight. And it would be very interesting to be a fly on the wall when that patient next returns to their doctors and says, well, here I am. What do you think now?
Yeah, this is actually medically documented. They call it spontaneous remission, spontaneous healing, and they don't fully understand it. There's different ways healing takes place, by the way. I mean, some people have a glowing figure enter into their room, and they think it's an angel.
Hmm?
Some of these could be angelic. There are people who have a near-death experience. In fact, we have a family friend here, my family, who was diagnosed with chronic cancer and was expected to die and did, had a near-death experience, went down the tunnel of light, and they said, it's not your time, go back, you'll be fine, and came back, and her cancer was gone. And I started looking into it, and I found a bunch of cases of people who were healed as a result of a near-death experience.
Hmm.
And in fact, I put a chapter on, you know, alternative healing in the book. I found some 30 cases. This shocked me, no pun intended, but people struck by lightning also experience healings of a wide variety of conditions, paralysis, all kinds of diseases. I mean, there's a connection here to light, I think, and energies. But at any rate, yeah, one interesting factor about this is, and this really shocked me, as a UFO researcher, I think researchers know that a case can take place anywhere, crowded suburb, in a hotel. I've got a bunch of cases of people who are visiting hotel rooms, you know, in very crowded areas. But 10%, a full 10% of these cases, which is significant, take place in the hospital,
yes,
in a person's hotel room. I just couldn't, I'm like, what? oh my gosh. But yeah, I mean, after getting, you know, some 30 cases, I mean, you're just kind of stuck with the evidence. This is happening in hospital rooms as well.
I think one of the cases that really stands out to me, and it makes me chuckle as well, is the lady, I think, is it Mrs. Sabine, who lived in Canada, who had basically been told that she was suffering from massive renal failure and she should prepare her affairs, Preston, because it didn't look very good for her. And then she gets a visit that ends up confounding all the medical practitioners, but the story doesn't end there.
Yeah, that's a fantastic case. She hadn't urinated for 3 days, went to the doctor. The doctor's like, you are in total renal failure. You have to go to the emergency room right now. Your life is in danger. And she went home first because she wanted to inform her family that she was basically dying, and she made a bunch of calls to her friends, her family, and her employers. And the next thing she knows, she passes out. And in the middle of the night, she's semi-conscious. There's these little figures around her. They're not grays. Most of the healings are done by grays, by the way, but really all different types of ETs. These were short little brown-skinned figures who were basically massaging her abdomen. It's her impression, and it went on for some time. She wakes up the next morning and goes to the bathroom. She's feeling good, goes to the doctor, and he is absolutely astounded. He doesn't know how to explain this. He says, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. Maybe I did a misdiagnosis. I don't see how this could happen. And everyone was very much surprised. She told everyone, well, I think I was visited by angels, and left it there until 3 months later, I think it was, where she was visited again. And this time she was actually taken on board, describes the typical rounded room, being laid out on a table, these short figures, details we hear over and over again in onboard UFO encounters. And these ETs place an instrument over her, which I've heard described many times from many people and certainly read about. It projects your body, the interior of your body, your organs, in full living color, like a hologram. And I said, here's your kidneys. Look, they look quite healthy, don't they? And she's like, yeah, they look great. And I said, here's your liver. Do you see all these black spots on it? And she looks at her liver in full living color. And yeah, it's speckled with these dark black spots. And they said, your liver is unhealthy. You need to stop drinking Diet Coke. It is damaging your liver, which is astounding because it's not the only case I know of where ETs are dispensing medical advice.
Mm-hmm.
One lady, they said, you're eating too many fatty foods. You're getting too fat. Stop eating fatty foods. She really dislikes being called fat by these grays, who she did not like. one guy, he was smoking too much, and the ET said, this is our gift to you, and handed him these containers filled with black goo, which stunk. He's like, what's this? This is a gift? And I said, yes, we pulled this out of your lungs. You need to stop smoking. I have two cases of that. One is from Jim Sparks, very well-known, fully conscious contactee, and another who's virtually unknown. And this unknown guy, he was taken again. He had started smoking marijuana. And the ETs took him on board and said, we want you to stop smoking marijuana. This is not the life we had planned for you. And when I heard that, I'm like, wow, wait, they're planning people's lives? they will dispense medical advice to people.
Yeah.
And it's not only physical healing. There was one guy who was suicidal. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have a few cases like this. And he was ready to end his life. Had actually driven out to the desert, had a gun, the whole deal. Tragic, really poignant. He had the gun up to his head when grays appeared. And he turns and he looks at them. That was all he needed, was someone to, you know, intervene. And as he says, it voided the suicide. And cured him of suicidal feelings. So they are healing a lot of different people of a wide, wide variety of conditions, including mental.
Yeah. I think that's one of the most striking things about the book, is that there are so many ailments and conditions that people are expressing these experiences in, Preston, that I think often when we have a specific part of ufology or the paranormal or anything, there is a natural tendency in human nature to look for trends or to see if they can spot what particular ailments the aliens seem to be most proficient in curing. But when you read your book, and it's such a weighty tome, as you say, because there are so many well-attested witness statements and additional evidence in some of these cases, that it clearly seems that for whatever reason, they will just intervene in certain people's lives to just try and alleviate any kind of pain they're going through, either, as you say, physical or mental.
Yeah, it's really amazing to me. The most common cure I found was of cancer, which really isn't a surprise because it's very widespread. It's one of the top 10 killers.
Mm-hmm.
Can affect any part of the body. And I found over 30 cases. But, you know, I wrote this case right before the whole pandemic struck and did a lot of research into, you know, healing and this sort of thing. Looking up the Center for Disease Control and the World Health Organization, there's the top 10 killers, which are, you know, cancer and respiratory disease. Suicide is actually number 10 in the U.S.
Mm.
But what I found is that these healing cases cover pretty much the entire spectrum of the top 10 killers of humanity.
Mm.
So they are... My point is, yeah, it's a very wide variety.
Yeah.
I found many, many cases of people healed of very, very minor conditions, cuts, bruises, broken bones, also sore back, chronic back pain, kidney disease, kidney stones, liver disease, tumors, you know, benign and cancerous, but serious diseases of all kinds, from, you know, hepatitis, jaundice, diphtheria, diabetes. And it's right down the line, gallstones, you name it an illness, I can pretty much say that, yes, they've cured that. There's 15 cases of people cured of various eye diseases. Here's one case that just puzzles me, loving a 13-year-old kid by the name of Chuck Doyle from Kentucky here in the U.S.
who had a head cold and was out in his backyard, and this UFO drops down and strikes him with a beam of light. Cures him of his head cold. Now, why? Why are they traveling light years to cure someone of the common cold? It's crazy.
Yeah. And it also seems to be fairly equal when it comes to the sexes, men and women. There doesn't seem to be any kind of favoritism on that level. It seems to anybody from any walk of life seems to be on their fix list, as it were.
Yeah, I really started to look into that because people are like, why are some people being healed and not others? I'm not healed.
Mm.
And so I started doing a statistical analysis, and yeah, it's evenly divided between men and women. There are people who are very elderly who have been healed, people who are quite young, I mean, infant, or little tiny kids. I mean, there's one case of a person who was apparently cured in utero, so age is not a factor, certainly not ancestry. If people of every, well, it's not race, but yeah, ancestral background.
Mm-hmm.
It's not blood type. One pattern I did find was that if you have a history of encounters, you know, if this is in your family, because it does track family lines, if you've been regularly contacted, your chances are much greater of having a healing. I would say a good 50% of the cases involve that category. Some involve friends of contactees, abductees. So if your friend has been contacted, that increases your chances. But another thing I found was just shocking to me because I kept looking. And I think the case that really tipped the scales for me was when a lady from Norway contacted me. She's like, I heard about your research of the healing. This happened to me. You know, I really want to share it with you. And she described how she was healed of back pain. She said it was very bad, chronic back pain. It was affecting her performance at her job.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, please don't use my name. You know, I'm pretty well known in my country. I'm like, oh, well, what do you do? She says, well, initially I was a graphic artist, but now I am very active in my country doing human rights and animal rights activism. And that rang a bell for me because I instantly thought of like 20 other cases involving people who were specifically social workers or human rights activists. So I started going down my list. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's an awful lot of doctors here. A lot of human rights activists, social workers, artists, musicians, writers, teachers, inventors, police officers, people who are doing good work for humanity in some capacity.
Hmm.
And it kept turning up after that. I'm like, that is absolutely a factor here. They are helping those who help others. Another case that comes to mind was a couple in Sedona, Arizona, who were driving along and were taken on board. They said it was very friendly. They weren't abducted. They were invited.
Mm-hmm.
Went of their own free will. People were on board were very friendly, mostly human-looking, but bald with large, dark eyes, and healed the husband of carpal tunnel syndrome and a bad knee. He was a postal carrier.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also a Navy guy, and was suffering from these conditions. And he was healed, and both of them are very active in their community in Hawaii. He helps people, you know, repair their homes, and she's an alternative healer doing herbal healing. And she asked him flat out, like, why did you heal us? Why don't you just land and help everybody? You could heal everyone. And they said, we can't. We cannot do that. It is up to you to solve your own problems. If we were to solve your problems, you would not learn. We are only intervening on a limited basis, and we are helping those who help others. So there was a clear message directly from the horse's mouth as to who is being healed and why.
Hmm. Is there any evidence in regards to a specific type of alien, Preston, that seems to be more prevalent in these cases? Is it mostly people encountering the greys or the lizards or, as you mentioned, the Nordics, which the more humanoid type, or even, I believe there are some cases involving the mantis aliens.
Yeah, you know, that was another shocking thing, because I kind of assumed it would be the friendly human contactee, you know, type ET, where they take you on board, they're beautiful, they take you on a tour of the craft, take you to their planet or what have you, and that turned out not to be the case. it's mostly grays. I was really shocked by that because grays have somewhat of a bad rap in this field. People are quite frightened often. And for that matter, praying mantis even more so. People find them very frightening.
Yeah.
Which I understand. I mean, they've got eyeballs the size of basketballs.
Yes.
And they're 8 feet tall and they're insectoid. What I found was mostly grays, about half. And often it's all different types. It's human looking, praying mantis. I even found a couple of reptilian cases, strange humanoids of every kind. And for that matter, it's not always even a humanoid. You can just be driving along or it hovers over your house. One case, which I loved, involved a guy who had kidney stones, and they're rushing him to the hospital. His friend turns out to be a contactee. And this poor guy is in the back seat, groaning in pain, laying down. And there's four people in the car, and they're rushing to the hospital. This is, I believe, in Brazil or Peru. David Del Mundo was the guy's name, and Hector Vasquez was the contactee. At any rate, they're on their way to the hospital, and this UFO drops down and starts circling the car. And does.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender, juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For a limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
You know, four or five rotations around their vehicle at very low level. This is a daylight sighting, and the guy with the kidney stones sits up. He says, "My pain is going away. I'm feeling much better. You know, I think something's happening." And everyone was quite surprised, because there was no onboard experience described, nothing like this. And they get to the hospital, and he's examined, and there's no sign of kidney stones whatsoever. One of several cases like that where, you know, just being in the presence of a UFO cured them. But yeah, one lady, no history of encounters whatsoever, was diagnosed with cancer, was very upset. She had breast cancer. And she and her husband are just weeping and wondering what to do. And that night they pray. They just pray to God, please heal us. And that night she finds herself on board, presumably a UFO. It's a small rounded room. Indirect lighting, there's a table, there's grays, and they didn't say anything. They just laid her out and started doing this procedure. And she went to the doctor the next day, or shortly thereafter, I think it was 3 days actually. And the doctor's like, "Well, you don't know what to tell you, but we can't find any trace of your cancer," which had been, you know, previously diagnosed with MRIs and blood tests and so forth. So there are some cases of people who have, you know, prayed or asked for healing, like Corrine Sabine, Sables, along those lines. But yeah, people ask for healing and receive it, but that's quite rare.
Do you think as well, as we often look back through history, Preston, that people would often prescribe these medical miracles to angels? And I know in your book, some people, regardless of what they describe being, to all intents and purposes, some kind of UFO contact, they still view these creatures as angels, don't they?
Yes, they do. And, you know, because of this, you know, very early on, I started investigating all aspects of the paranormal. As people were reporting out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences and ghosts and precognition and, you know, all kinds of paranormal events. Bigfoot. I'm like, oh, no. Bigfoot, really? So I really started looking into all different aspects of it. And that certainly includes angels and, for that matter, demons, because some people think this is a demonic phenomena, which it isn't. I can tell you hands down it's not. And I think the literature on both, you know, angels is certainly very compelling. But some of these cases are very hard to categorize when you're, like I mentioned earlier, a glowing being enter your room. And you can't really see it other than it's a figure and it cures you. How do you interpret that? Is that angelic or is it ET? I think most of these are clearly ET. I put a little chapter on angelic healings, which I felt could probably be, you know, categorized as honest to God angelic healings. But I will say, I did talk to one lady. She had a tumor in her lung, and doctors were like, well, we're going to have to remove 3/4 of your right lung.
Hmm.
And she had this painful pain in her chest and this protrusion, and was diagnosed with a large tumor. And before she could have surgery, ETs came, they plunged their hand into her chest. She said it was quite painful.
Mm.
But they said, we've healed you. You know, you had a problem. We've healed you. And later she had an encounter with what she believes is her hybrid son. She said, I'm your son. You know, you gave birth to me. And we watch over you. And gave her all kinds of information. Said, you need to tell people to stop eating meat. There's no need for people to eat so much meat. It's not good for you. You need to tell people to stop putting out the greed and negativity you're putting out, because you will destroy your planet like we did. They said, you're in for some very intense environmental changes upcoming. There's going to be a lot of hurricanes. There's a huge earthquake fault that's going to, you know, break at some point. And just start going down the line. They said, we've been intervening with human genetics for millennia, not only human genetics, but animals. I said, we have upgraded the genetics of cats and dogs specifically to make them more emotionally compatible with humans. I thought that was crazy and just really interesting. I said, if people should start disappearing from our planet, it's being done by us for the universal good. But important here is they told her, who you thought were angels was us. You have interpreted us as angels, but that was actually us. So that definitely makes me wonder, because there are many cases throughout history which could have been interpreted, you know, in modern times, certainly, as an ET encounter rather than angelic.
I think there are a few trains of thought in regards to that, that depending on the type of phenomenon that appears to people in a variety of forms, Preston, that sometimes the consensus seems to be that whatever people experience appears in the form that makes them feel more comfortable.
Yes. Yes, there's definitely something to that. We see that with near-death experiences. People will report seeing the religious figure of their culture.
Hmm.
We do see that with UFO encounters, particularly with children who have figures enter their room. They're dressed up as clowns.
Hmm.
Which, unfortunately, I think backfired. I've heard, you know, kids reporting everything from superheroes to Barbie dolls to 3-foot-tall teddy bears. I've had several people describe Muppets.
Hmm.
And they started having Muppet nightmares following this. But, you know, even adults will report ETs appearing as, no, cowboys. One lady was a horse farmer, and she had an ET approach her wearing a cowboy hat and sort of a paste-on mustache. So, yeah, they will sort of assume the appearance of something that's perhaps less frightening in many cases.
Well, it's one of those books, Preston, that when you start reading it, you think, well, I'll give this a go. And then by the end of it, you're like scratching your head because, as I said, it seems to be nothing is beyond the realms of being cured in this. And there are so many compelling witnesses, as you say, from all around the world, from near enough every continent, that clearly there is something going on. And when we have this body of evidence that's supported by medical professionals and the medical records, then it does make you wonder why people just don't want to talk about this.
Yeah. People really need to step back and discard their prejudices and prior belief systems and, you know, awaken the scientists within them. There's a lot of shoe-fitting and cherry-picking in this field, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
People will put forth a theory and find cases that support it, and that's easy to do, but that's not true science.
Yeah.
The evidence comes first. And then you can form whatever theory you want to account for all the evidence. This is why I think that we're dealing with extraterrestrials. The extraterrestrial theory really is the one that best fits the evidence. People just need to say, okay, I mean, how many cases do you need? How many reports do you need to say that this is actually happening? I mean, the evidence for healings is in my mind, certainly conclusive. As a researcher who's really buckled down on this, I can tell you, if you look at the evidence, it's absolutely undeniable. One guy, Jim Schaefer, I mentioned briefly, cured of cancer. He actually filmed this orb going into his body, filmed it. You can see this online. He had been diagnosed with a tumor on his neck, which was protruding and visible and was due for surgery in a week, and had this experience with this orb coming into his body, goes to bed and wakes up the next morning and his tumor is gone. It is not there. Goes to the doctor and tells them, yeah, but they came again. You know, they removed it. And the doctor's like, wow, okay. Well, we're going to proceed with surgery because there's some necrotic tissue here, and we will see if there's any cancer to remove. But there wasn't. They just, you know, did a minor surgery. Well, fairly extensive, I should say, but certainly not as extensive as it would have been.
Yes.
And did not mark in his chart that, you know, ETs healed him. Because as a medical professional, they weren't there. They didn't see it happen. I can understand that. But they put, I saw the medical records, spontaneous healing, unexplained. So they went as far as they could to, you know, accept this as, you know, a UFO healing, so to speak. But I can only imagine what it's like for the medical professionals. One lady, one of the first cases I interviewed, it was a lady who was healed of a tumor in her fallopian tube, went to the doctor. She had a healing that night. I call this the last minute phenomena. You should wait till the night before surgery. I don't know why they do that, but they do. She goes to the doctor and they can't, you know, they did the pre-op MRIs and said, we cannot find your tumor. You went to the doctor, didn't you? And she said, no, I didn't. I said, well, you're lying. The tumor is gone. We know you did. There's fluid here in your fallopian tubes. It's only present if someone has surgery. Where did you go? And she played dumb. She says, I didn't go anywhere. I said, well, here's a laser mark on your abdomen. We know you had surgery. And she still just played dumb. And I asked her about that. I'm like, why didn't you just say? She says, are you kidding? They would have locked me up. I don't want to be, you know, locked up by the guys in white coats.
Yeah.
And I had to respect that because I know a case of a lady in England, actually, who had a witness to her UFO sighting, and her parents institutionalized her despite having a corroborating witness. I know of other cases like that where people have been put in mental hospitals for reporting a UFO.
But it's always one of those to be thankful, though. It's not something that seems to be that common these days, Preston, when people come forward. The old cliches used to be, you know, people are wearing tinfoil hats and they're clearly just paranoid or delusional. But I think because it's now such a worldwide phenomenon and well reported, we're past that point. You still see it occasionally pop up, usually at a local media level. But I think certainly the major media outlets seem to be far more balanced and less judgmental when anybody comes forward with a remarkable story such as these.
Yeah, we've definitely come a long way over the decades. And just recently, these past 3 years or so, there's been some really remarkable strides with our, you know, the Pentagon disclosures and the congressional hearings here in the U.S. and high-level government officials, Paul Hellyer, the former defense minister of Canada, basically coming forward. You know, England and France and Brazil and Chile and U.S. were all declassifying documents. And I think that this disclosure movement, we've just reached a level of saturation of reports of evidence that to not disclose would make you not credible.
Yeah.
I don't think our governments are disclosing for the good of the people. I really don't. I think they're, you know, basically their hand is being forced.
Yes.
They are disclosing only because if they don't, they will lose complete control over the narrative.
Yeah.
So it's still good news. You know, now they're using the word UFO and UAP and extraterrestrial in the same sentence.
Yeah.
They still won't admit it. They're not saying they know what this is. And they do. They 100% know. We know they know. They know we know they know. I mean, just the dam is broke. Their days are numbered. This cover-up is no longer sustainable. So I think there's a lot of panic within the secret government, as you might call it, as to how to handle this hundreds upon hundreds of whistleblowers coming out of the woodwork.
Definitely. Well, Preston, thank you as always. It's always wonderful to have a deep dive into your work and your books, because they just fascinate me. Every time I get one of your new books, I just find myself stunned by the witness statements and the evidence and the encounters that you include. So for anybody that's yet to own a copy of these books, which I heartily recommend and can't believe that anybody into ufology hasn't got any of your work, where can everybody get hold of copies and follow your work online, my friend?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I do have a website, PrestonDennett.Weebly.com is the address, but I think you just punch my name in on the internet, it'll take you there. And you can certainly contact me to my website and read excerpts of my book and order them through my website. Amazon is also a great place, or any online retailer or bookstores can, you should be able to find them there, or certainly order them. I'm all over social media if you want to contact me on Facebook or Twitter or what have you. I'm there. I've got my own YouTube channel, which is growing fast. I'm very excited about it. I really appreciate you having me on the show. I think this is an important subject, and I can't wait. So it's taught in schools, and I can go to a museum and see the Roswell crash myself, the craft. I want to see the bodies. Come on, show us. Tell the truth. It's not that hard.
Yes, very true. So before I let you go, what's next for you?
Well, I just put out a book called Symmetry, a true UFO adventure about a fully conscious contactee. That hit number one on Amazon under UFOs. Super excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have a recent television appearance on Unexplained. It's a program with William Shatner.
Yes, that's shown over here as well. I'm a big fan of that show.
Yeah, it's one of my better shows out there, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
I do have a new book coming out, part of my Not From Here series, all about the more unexplained aspects or the rare outline cases.
Yep.
So that'll be Not From Here, Volume 4. Got another book in line after that. I'm keeping busy.
Good. Glad to hear it. And no doubt I will be moving books about on my shelf to make room for whatever you've got planned. So thank you as always, Preston. It's never a disappointment speaking with you. And no doubt we will speak again in the future. You take care and thank you again.
Hey, thank you.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.